Once about in a generation, there's a scientific announcement which really captures the public imagination. And one of these announcements, announcement by a team from Johnson Space Center and Stanford on their results on the search for past life on Mars. One of the team leaders is Dr. David McKay, who is visiting Australia at the invitation of the Australian Key Centre for Microscopy and Microanalysis in Sydney. We are delighted that he's been able to divert to Melbourne. In fact, I believe he's planning to spend the weekend here, much to the consternation of people in Sydney. But it's with pleasure that I invite Dr. McKay to tell us about the search for past life on Mars. David, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bruce. It's my pleasure to be here. I'm not sure whether you see the X-Files in Australia. Do we get X-Files here? Okay, you know that one of the favorite things on X-Files is a secret conspiracy that is working behind the scenes to do various things. And we actually, in NASA, get accused sometimes of being part of that conspiracy, of covering up things and of plotting things, to strange things to happen. So when I came into to Sydney on Monday, as soon as I was here, a Russian Mars spacecraft threatened to fall out of the sky and contaminate us all with plutonium. And I want to deny that NASA had anything to do with that at all. That is not part of the conspiracy. In fact, I think it might be the other way around, because not only did that disrupt my lecture tour by blocking the roads and but by causing a lot of press attention, but President Clinton, of course, came the next day, and he blocked the roads and closed the airports, and so I found it hard to get to Canberra then. And then tonight I find that I'm in competition with Michael Jackson. So there's some deep conspiracy going on here. All right, what I'd like to do is go through some lines of evidence that led us to the conclusion that there may be early life on Mars, and I want to go through some of the thought processes, the reasoning that leads to that conclusion, and then I'll talk a little bit about some new material that's come out since the big publicity effort, and then I'll finish up with a few words about where we go from here. What do I think will happen next? So what I want to do now is go through some slides, and there are a fair number of slides, but I'll go through them at a good pace. So bear with me, because these slides will more or less explain the logic of our data and our conclusions. Okay, this is the title of our paper, is published in Science in August. And I just want to indicate that this has been a team effort. We have three people here from Johnson Space Center. We have a bunch of people from Stanford. And then we have a Canadian and a Kentuckian here. And so we have, it was kind of an international effort. Um, In 1976, NASA landed two spacecraft on the surface of Mars. These were the Viking spacecraft. They also, as part of that effort, there were two orbiters that orbited Mars and took thousands of photographs. The lander took this photograph, one of the landers, and this is day 556. Those landers were remarkable. They operated for a couple of years, and that's well into the second year. We have an incredible amount of data about Mars from those two spacecraft. Most of what we know about Mars, we attribute to that to those remarkable accomplishments. Recently, we sent the Mars Observer there, and it didn't make it. That was about 3 years ago. So now we have launched, a few weeks ago, another spacecraft to Mars that will orbit Mars and take more pictures and do some more spectral studies. And we have, in fact, a lander that will be launched in a couple more weeks that will land on the surface of Mars. And it has a little rover that'll drive around and take pictures and do some chemistry and broadcast back the data. So it's an exciting time for Mars missions, although we were sincerely sorry that the Russian mission has failed. We hope that these two U.S. missions will provide new data. To get back to Viking, one of the disappointments of Viking was that although it had a lot of sophisticated instruments on board, it failed to detect any sign of life on Mars. There were no organics in the soil. There was no, they attempted to culture life, cellular life. Nothing happened. Absolutely negative results. So people more or less forgot about life on Mars for a long time after that. This is one of the Viking photos. Now, the thing about Mars is that from the photography, we see that Mars has craters like the Moon, but it also has a series of features related to water. This particular feature is the ejecta blanket from this crater, and it's called a rampart blanket because it has a fairly steep front. And the interpretation is that this crater, this impact, hit into ice, into permafrost, and melted the ice, and essentially this was a fluidized flow of ice and water and dirt, and at this point it froze again and simply froze into that pattern. So there's indirect evidence of this sort, plus models that say that there's probably a lot of ice on Mars underneath the surface. And the other thing about that, if there's ice and you go deeper because of the geothermal gradient, that is heat coming up from below, at some point you're into water. So there's a model for groundwater on Mars. Even though there's no water on the surface, there may be a lot of water in the ground. And that's key to our story. So just keep that in mind. All right. Our story begins, really, with an impact on the surface of Mars, a big impact of a comet or perhaps an asteroid, which blasted off some rocks from Mars, and this was thought not to be possible until we started finding Mars meteorites, and then the theorists went back to the drawing boards and figured out how this could happen with computer models. So this was blasted off into space, some rocks. Some of the rocks went into the sun eventually. The rock we're interested in was probably part of a bigger rock, and it wandered around in space for 16 million years. It was lost in space in a chaotic orbit for 16 million years. We know that accurately because of the cosmic ray effects on the rock chemistry. The chemistry has been measured, and the cosmic rays have built up over time a series of radioactive elements. And by measuring those, we know it's time and space. Well, this rock somehow came close enough to the Earth to get caught up in the Earth's gravitational pull, and it started falling through the atmosphere. It probably broke up into a lot of smaller rocks. 80% of them perhaps went into the ocean, because that's where 80% of the Earth is ocean. But a few of them, or at least one, fell in Antarctica. So what we see here is what happens when a meteorite falls in Antarctica. This is a cartoon showing a meteorite falls here on these blue ice areas, which are big ice sheets or ice flows, and they slowly move downhill from the South Pole toward the ocean, way over here somewhere. And as they move, anything that falls on the surface gets more or less sucked in, and then goes under the ice. And then if the ice meets an obstruction, like a mountain range, the flowage comes back to the surface, and the meteorite then is left on the surface as the wind evaporates the ice. So this is the basic process by which meteorites fall in Antarctica and they're recovered in Antarctica. And this was first realized about 15 years ago by the Japanese, and the U.S. Started sending an expedition down there every year. Japanese do too. And they have brought back something like 10,000 meteorites from Antarctica now. It's been a real gold mine for meteorites. It has increased the world supply by about a factor of 10. Well, this is a typical summer day in Antarctica, and this is a U.S. expedition a few years ago showing that they do have sometimes severe conditions even in the summer, but they go anyway. And this is what a meteorite looks like in the field. This is how they are. They're often on little pedestals here of ice, and the wind is blowing away the ice around them. Eventually it would fall down, and then another pedestal would erode. You see these every 1,000 meters or less sometimes. And 95% of the rocks that you see on the surface turn out to be meteorites rather than Antarctic rocks, because there's just no good way to get an Antarctic rock into this ice flow. These meteorites are collected by the field party, and they're brought back, and they're put in cabinets in Houston, and they're kept under nitrogen so they don't rust when they warm up into the Houston humidity. And so they try to keep them clean using techniques developed for the lunar samples. In 1979, one of these rocks, 79001, was recovered from Antarctica, and it was sliced open. Typically, these meteorites are sliced or chipped so that they can be identified. Well, this one, it turned out, when it was sliced open, had a lot of little black specks in it. And these black specks are impact glass. They're glass created by the impact in that painting, which blasted the rock, this particular rock, off of Mars. Now, what is interesting about that glass is that within that glass, there is trapped gas. And when that gas was analyzed, it became clear that gas, which was mostly carbon dioxide, and then had some nitrogen, and then had some of the rare gases here. This is the analysis of that, those little glass black things. And this, in fact, is the analysis of the Mars atmosphere as broadcast back in 1976 by Viking. And the air bars are about the size of these circles, so there's not much error in that curve. And so what we're seeing here is almost an exact match between this trapped glass, trapped gas in the glass in this meteorite and the composition of the Mars atmosphere. Now, there's nothing else in the inner solar system that has anything like this composition. Venus has a lot of CO2, but none of the other components fall on this kind of line. They're much different. Earth is of course, quite different. Nitrogen is much more abundant than CO2. So we know the atmosphere of Venus, and we know the atmosphere of Jupiter through Galileo, and we know the composition of the Mars atmosphere from Viking. And there's a very nice match here only for Mars. So that is, we call this the Rosetta Stone. That particular meteorite is the key to understanding and being certain that meteorites come here from Mars. Now, I'm sorry, this is dark. We're having a slide problem. But the other bit of evidence is that these are oxygen isotopes, and you don't have to worry about the details, but notice this line here. Those are all the Mars meteorites. It's a very tight family. Now, oxygen isotopes, the way it works is that they're allowed to move up and down this line through natural processes, but they can't get off that line. That line itself is determined by the original reservoir from which that oxygen came. In other words, the planet from which it came. This is the Earth down here. The Moon is about here. Carbonaceous chondrites are way off the page and so forth. So there is a tight group here of meteorites, numbering 12. Among that group is this Rosetta Stone that I talked about with the Mars gas in it. So the logic is that if that is from Mars, then the rest of these guys have to be from Mars as well. And that's the basic answer when people ask, how do we know these rocks are from Mars? It's a combination of those two kinds of analyses. There are other things, too. There's a lot more chemistry to bolster this argument, but this is the basic reason. Now, this is a summary of those Mars meteorites, 12 of them. The biggest one is Nakhla at 40 kilograms. The Allen Hills is the one I'm going to talk about mostly. It's about 2 kilograms. And about half of these were found in Antarctica. The other half were seen to fall from the sky all over the world and were put into museums. This one, the Chassinet, was found in 1815. It fell out of the sky in France, and it was put in the Paris Museum. Nakhla, I think, fell in Egypt, and Kill the Dog. That's the only fatality from a Mars meteorite so far. So that's a bunch of them. Now, this is the Allen Hills one. It was the last one on that list, and it is about the size of a large potato. It's 2 kilograms. It's green, except it's black here where there's a fusion crust which formed during the atmospheric entry. That meteorite then, although it was only identified as a Mars meteorite a couple years ago, it was found in 1984. And what happened is it spent 10 years in Houston in a cabinet, and it, because it had been misidentified as another kind of meteorite, a diogenite, which is probably a piece of an asteroid, perhaps Vesta. And so in 1994, a scientist at Johnson, David Mittelfeld, got it out and made a thin section of it and got some other diogenites, and he wanted to study diogenites. So he looked at all these, and he looked at this one, and he said, that's not a diogenite. It just doesn't match diogenites. And he was about to push it back in the cabinet and forget about it when he suddenly realized that the characteristics of this were like a bunch of meteorites called SNCC meteorites, which became later known to be the Mars meteorites. So it was discovered by chance to be a Mars meteorite only 2 years ago. Now, what do we know about it? It's been age-dated. It formed in 4.5 billion years ago. It was part of the very early crust of Mars. And it's a volcanic rock, an igneous rock, and it's mainly the mineral orthopyroxene, which is iron, magnesium silicate. It contains some strange carbonates in it, which I'll talk about more. These carbonates were not part of the original rock, but rather they came in to some cracks in the rock on Mars, but between 1 and 3.6 billion years ago. That date is awfully fuzzy, and people are trying to firm that up. This date we know quite well. It was blasted off of Mars 16 million years ago. It landed in Antarctica 13,000 years ago based on radiocarbon information. So we have a pretty good history of this rock. Now, as people started looking at it, when it was broken open, sometimes along what appeared to be pre-existing cracks in it, we saw, and other people saw, these little orangey-looking things. They're only about a quarter millimeter, half a millimeter. These turned out to be carbonate. And if we look at them a little more closely, they're hard to get good pictures of, but they're orange. That's probably about a third of a millimeter across there. But all of them have a characteristic rim to them, which is black, white, and black. And we see that repeated on this one, black, white, and black. And what are these? What's going on here? So that was one of the questions that we had. When we looked at a lot of these, we see that many of them are pancake-shaped like this, and this is the orange carbonate. Carbonate is a calcium carbonate, is a carbonate, for example. That is mineral calcite, or limestones, or carbonates. It's a very common mineral on the earth. So furthermore, it is unusual in volcanic rocks. It's almost never found in volcanic rocks. So it's clearly a later addition to the rock. So anyway, we looked at these, and this is an electron microscope view of one of those broken surfaces showing the carbonate globules, orange with the complicated rim. And notice there are a bunch of little baby ones here too, which appear to be mostly rim without much orange in the center of them. So these were very curious, and so the first thing we did was ask ourselves, how do these form? What do they mean? We had, in the meantime, been, even before we started looking at this Mars meteorite, we had been analyzing a bunch of other meteorites and also little cosmic dust grains. We'd been analyzing them for something called pause, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. This is a form of a kind of organic compound. One of the common ones, perhaps, is what makes up mothballs. That's a polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon that has a strong odor to it. And most of these, in fact, have strong odors. But what do we know about it? They're produced on the earth from car exhaust and factory activity, human activity. They're produced in old material like coals and oil. They're produced here by the decay of living matter. And that was something that struck our interest, knowing that these things could be produced by living matter decay. So we've been analyzing meteorites for PAWS for several years. So what we did was take this Mars meteorite, and we took a couple chips of it, and we shipped it to our friends at Stanford who actually do the analysis, and we didn't tell them what it was. We called this chip Minnie and this chip Mickey, and shipped them out there, and they shipped back the results. And here's what they found, that on those surfaces, like I just showed you, there indeed are PAWS, and they're relatively abundant in the as these things go. These are the main ones. They're benzene rings, carbon compounds, and these are the names of them, and these are the relative abundance. So this was kind of unusual. Here we have organic material in this Mars meteorite. Where did this stuff come from? Well, our choice is contamination from the Earth, because we know that PAWS are around on the Earth, or our choice is perhaps from space. Now, in space, we know that there are PAWS which come from the early solar system and from even the interstellar dust cloud. These are things formed by strictly inorganic processes, and some meteorites have a lot of them, namely the carbonaceous chondrite meteorites have a lot of these things in them, but they're inherited from the early solar system. So we started to compare the PAWS in our Mars meteorite to other kinds of PAWS. And this is the terrestrial soil sample. This, if you go out here in the grass and dig some up, and we stick it into our mass spectrometer, this is what you get. Now, remember that previous pattern had four simple peaks. So this is not at all like that. This is a typical sample of the background contamination on the Earth. Some of this is from forest fires. Some of it is from car exhaust. Who knows what the rest of it is from? But it's much more complicated. Now, we also were able to map the PAWS that we found on those surfaces. This is about a 700 micrometer square here. And as the mass spec, which it has a laser to desorb or blast off the PAWS, as it operated, it would scan back and forth, and then a computer would make this map. And there are areas here that are high or hot in PAWS, and many of those areas correspond to those little carbonate things that we're curious about. So we noted that not all, but many of them are. In other words, the carbonates are the site of some of the PAW concentrations. Now, I said that other meteorites have PAWs in them, mainly the carbonaceous chondrites, and we've analyzed a lot of those. All these are carbonaceous chondrites. And if you look at these peaks, these kinds of PAWs, and do something called a mass-weighted average. In other words, you average these and you give more weight to the heavy ones. this is what you get for all these meteorites, but the Mars meteorite is way up here. It's really quite different from the field in which all the carbonaceous chondrites lie, and this is some of our reasoning. This justifies some of our reasoning that these paws are not from the same source as the carbonaceous chondrites. So to finish up on the organic story, we found organics in the meteorite associated with the carbonates. The organics can be made by earth contamination or early solar system processes, but another possibility is that these paws, are made by the decay of once living matter. And that's the one that we favor because the other lines of evidence also support the idea that there was living matter there. So that's the organic story. It's the first time organics have been identified in Mars samples. And if you remember, Viking didn't find any, but our group, the Stanford group, found these. And we went through very careful contamination control experiments and to show that it was not contamination either from Antarctica or within our laboratories. All right, let's go look at some of these globules again. This is a chemical map. We have an electron microprobe machine that can look at these things, and this is about a millimeter across here. And what we're doing here is looking at the element iron. We're seeing only iron. This is a really nifty machine that allows you to see one element at a time. And the brighter the spot, the more iron there is. So this is the background area of the orthopyroxene, has a little bit of iron in it. This mineral has no iron. And look at our globules. They have zones in them, and particularly these outer zones are very bright. That one is bright, dark bright. The bright ones are loaded with iron. Now, keeping that picture in mind, look at this next one. This is sulfur. We're seeing only sulfur now, and in this picture, clearly, the sulfur is in the same area as the iron. So what we're doing is making a map now of where the elements are. Now, iron and sulfur, as we'll see, play a role in this story later on. But so remember how they're concentrated in these bands. Also, there's a little bit inside the globules, and there are a few bright specks out here, particularly in those little baby guys that I'd pointed out earlier. This is simply the element manganese, Mn. It's concentrated in the center. All right, now, about this time, we started to wonder and worry about how these carbonates were formed. We knew something about them. We knew that they were the site of some organic chemicals. We knew their composition and that they were zoned. So how did they form? So we started looking in a number of natural systems on the Earth, and they're both high-temperature ways to form carbonates and low-temperature ways. And for various theoretical reasons, we didn't like the high-temperature processes. We said it had to be low-temperature. And in low-temperature processes, there are ways to get these carbonates. There are really two ways. One way is strictly inorganic precipitation. But the other way, the way that we tended to gravitate to, was precipitation with the help of bacteria. And that's what we see here is a tiny carbonate dumbbell that was formed in a beaker in the laboratory into which some water from the Gulf of Mexico was placed. And that water was from an area rich in microorganisms. Right next to it, there was an equivalent beaker, but the water had been sterilized. Well, the water that had not been sterilized grew lots of these calcium, this is calcium and magnesium carbonate, grew lots of these things. The other water grew nothing. What is happening here is that the bacteria have catalyzed the precipitation of the calcium carbonate. Now, in other places in this experiment, like the surface of the water, the beaker, these things are somewhat restricted, and so instead of forming dumbbells, they form these pancake-like forms. Well, the people that did this experiment, shown here, also etched them with a little bit of acid, and when they're etched, they're found to be intricately zoned, and this zoning is a chemical zoning, and it is similar to the zoning that we see in the Mars carbonates. So this the combination of this known model from nature and from the laboratory with our data about the Mars carbonates allows us to propose that the Mars carbonates may also have been precipitated with the aid of bacteria. So that's part of our argument, that there are systems which produce very similar things and which require bacteria. Doesn't prove that the Mars ones had to have bacteria, but allows us to propose that as a reasonable hypothesis. All right, we looked into this more completely now with the electron microscope. This is our co-author, Kathy Thomas, looking with a transmission electron microscope. What we do is pick off these little carbonate pancakes and pour epoxy on them and then slice them up with a diamond knife, a microtome, until they're we have a bunch of 100 nanometer thick sections. Now that's pretty thin. A human hair is about 50 micrometers in width, and 100 nanometers is in fact a tenth of 1 micrometer. So you're talking about 1/500th of the width of a human hair. That's how thick these are. But that's okay. That technique has been around for a long time to do that. And so we just did that. And then we put them in the electron microscope, and we can shine the electron beam through them. And when we do that, we're able to get chemistry, because the electron beam generates X-rays, which we pick up and which tell us what elements are there. And we can also get mineralogy, because the electron beam interacts in certain ways with different minerals, and that's all well understood. So we can actually measure the atomic planes in here and tell what mineral it is. Well, this is a picture with the electron microscope of one of these rims that we saw earlier that was rich in iron and rich in sulfur. And what we see here is a series of little grains of magnetite, MT. C stands for carbonate grains. The magnetite ones are more dense and therefore darker in this picture. But these guys are iron oxide, Fe3O4. And this is just another view to show. This is called dark field, and it simply shows that they're well crystallized, or else they would not be bright. And this is a closer view showing some of the magnetites. So notice the scale here, 100 nanometers or 1/500th of the thickness of a human hair. Pretty tiny stuff. As we zoomed in on those even more, we could actually see, and I'm not sure you can see it here, but there are some diagonal lines that go down through here, and that is those are the atomic planes. Each one of those lines is an atomic plane. We're not really seeing individual atoms, but we're seeing essentially where they stack up along a line. So it's close. And by measuring the distance between those little lines, we can tell that it's the mineral magnetite. Now, let's stop a minute and think about where this magnetite comes from. As you saw, it was all over the place, and it was in these two bands, which are all part of those carbonate nodules. We previously had data to show that those carbonate nodules, including the bands, had to come from Mars. And I didn't go into that in detail, but it is clear that they were formed on Mars. And it is clear, therefore, that this magnetite was formed on Mars. So, but where did it come from? Magnetite is a fairly common mineral on the Earth. And it's formed inorganically and organically. The main way it's formed organically is by bacteria. This is a kind of bacteria which forms magnetite grains inside its cell body, and these magnetite grains are then used by the bacteria for orientation and locomotion. They line up with the magnetic field of the Earth, and they enable the cell to move in certain directions along magnetic lines of force. There is another kind of bacteria which makes magnetite on the outside. It really doesn't care about the magnetite after it makes it, but it makes it as part of the process of getting energy through reduction or oxidation reactions. And then it would just as soon throw away the magnetite. So a lot of magnetite in nature is made by bacteria, and the magnetite made by bacteria is awfully tiny, these are some close-up views of some of the bacteria magnetite found in sediments, and these are called magnetofossils. These are considered to be fossils. They're the remains. There's all that's left of the those bacteria that made them. The bacteria rot away and leave these magnetites. Now, the comparison is rather striking between our magnetite from Mars and the magnetite made by Earth bacteria. You can see the different parameters that are compared. We found, remember the sulfur in those bands, we found a lot of sulfides, iron sulfides. This is pyrrhotite, which is FeS or iron sulfide grains, and these are fairly common. They're not as common as magnetite, but they're fairly common throughout those bands. And then we found another kind of sulfur called greggite, which is Fe3S4 as the magnetite structure. But it is on the Earth, greggite is most commonly found only in situations where it has clearly been precipitated by bacteria. There is some inorganic greggite, but it's really hard to find, and it tends to be much bigger crystals. I have not found any reference to tiny greggite formed by inorganic processes on the Earth. All right, then our next bit of evidence, and our last bit of evidence, is the pictures, the scanning electron microscope pictures of the sample itself. So far, the evidence has consisted of, yes, the rocks from Mars, Yes, the carbonates are from Mars and were formed on Mars, but were formed after the rock. Yes, there are organic chemicals in there, and they're associated with these carbonates. And yes, there are these minerals, which, although we can't prove they were made by bacteria, are certainly similar to ones that we're familiar with that are made by bacteria, and it's hard to find ones like them that are not made by bacteria on the Earth. So far, that's our evidence. So the last little bit of evidence that we got, and I'll tell you about some British evidence as well, it has to do with the pictures. As we looked at those carbonates with a high-resolution electron microscope, we found that the carbonates, most of the carbonates, looked a little bit like this. These are cleavage planes. This is a fairly normal way that carbonates grow and also carbonates dissolve if you're trying to dissolve them along cleavage planes. But when we looked in the vicinity of those rims, those iron sulfur-rich rims, we found a totally different texture that looked like this. And the texture contained a number of strange forms. One of the most characteristic forms we call the clams. Looks like this. Here's one down here. And then they're elongated things. And then there's a number of spherical or round forms. What are these guys? We suppose that some of them have to be those minerals that we found in the other kind of microscope, that is the magnetite and the sulfide minerals. But some of these don't look like anything that we could pick out in the transmission scope. And so some of them we think are not those minerals, and we proposed in our article that they might be, in fact, tiny fossils, nanofossils, we call them, or microfossils, from Mars. And that raised up a big storm of controversy and protest, which I'll tell about. But this is just another area from another nodule. We looked at a lot of these, and they all had the same kind of thing in the rims. Notice again one of the clam-like forms, and possibly one there as well. And another area, this elongated form and this one both have little lines down the center, and we're not sure what that means, but we saw that over and over again. Now, as I said, we were criticized for this, and a lot of the criticism came from the biology community, because we had inadvertently and naively stepped into what had already been a big argument between the biology community and the geology community over how small an organism can really be. And the biologists are familiar with organisms down to about as small as 0.1 to 0.2 micrometers, and they say you cannot have anything smaller because there is not room in the volume to put what you need to put, the DNA and the enzymes and the proteins that are needed for the cell to process food and energy and reproduce. There's just physically not room for these things once you're down to a certain size. On the other hand, the geologists are finding pretty tiny ones as they look around in various geological environments. And there's a community of geologists that believes that these nanobacteria, as they're called, are real. And they're real, they're all over the place in nature, and they should be recognized and studied. I'm going to show you an example from the geologists of some of these things that they call nanobacteria. Now, this is from some hot springs material from Italy by Bob Folk at University of Texas. These are pretty clearly bacteria. They just look an awful lot like bacteria, and they're half micron, 0.5. So these are in the range allowed by the biologists, but they get smaller. So here we now have ones that go down to about 0.1 micrometer. This is on a calcite grain. And are these things really microorganisms? I think everybody agrees that when they're half a micron large, that's okay. But once you get down to 0.1 or 0.2, then the biologists call this kind of I call it a forbidden zone, where it may not be allowed to have living organisms. But yet, people are seeing things that they identify as such. And here's even some smaller ones. These are less than 300 nanometers, which is quite a bit below the allowable size. And here's even smaller ones that are less than 100 nanometers or 0.1 micrometer. These were interpreted by other groups as being nanoorganisms or nanofossils in the case of older ones. And here's even smaller ones. I've been going down in scale to some really tiny ones that you can barely see there. And these things are just basically, that one is probably no more than 50 nanometers. And that's only 500 angstroms. That means that you can't, there's room in there to line up 500 atoms, and that's it. And that's really tiny. All right, so this summarizes some of the geological work. People think they see these. The microbiologists don't buy them, but the geologists believe they see them, and they even believe they can culture them and get them to grow. Since we got caught in the middle of this by proposing these small Mars things might be organisms, we had to familiarize ourselves with some of the Earth examples. So we got from an investigator in Washington State some of the Columbia River basalt from deep down. This is about 2 kilometers underneath the surface, and it contains, as shown by the investigator, it contains living material which can live and generate oxygen and so forth, and lives down there very happily without any sunlight, and simply lives off the CO2 and hydrogen underground. Anyway, we saw little tiny things here, but from 80 nanometers up to about 0.2 micrometers, and we saw rod-shaped things. We saw a lot of these. And this kind of summarizes what we found. Essentially, there are a lot of things in this forbidden zone. And our interpretation would be that those are really nanobacteria. Although that interpretation is not collaborated by other kinds of evidence like organic analysis. Well, going back to the Mars meteorite, in some places on the Mars meteorite, there are these, as opposed to little spheres, there are these long things that are somewhat curved. In some places, they're fairly common, and they seem to be on top of the carbonate or even buried partially in the carbonate. People have seen similar things. This is a volcanic rock from Sicily, and it has a lot of little wormy-looking things in, which are the same size as what we see. We looked at some desert varnish. This is quite common in Australia. It's a film that builds up on rocks left out in the desert, and it turns them brown normally or sometimes black. It's mainly iron and manganese oxide. And there's a school of thought, still a little controversial, that they're that these desert varnishes are formed entirely by bacterial activity. So we looked at some of these, and we started seeing a lot of these elongate things, which are only between 100 and 200 nanometers in length. Again, this is the size of what we see in the Mars meteorite. Now, are these microorganisms? We don't know, but it's certainly suspicious. And then finally, from another publication by somebody else, they're seeing little tiny spheres and thread-like things, long threads, which they interpret, again, as nanobacteria. But notice the threads are really, although they're a micrometer or so long, they're really skinny. They're just 20 nanometers in thickness. Well, back to the Mars meteorite. This picture is one that was on the web and was fairly well distributed. This is typical of a number of forms that we found. These are elongate. They're 200 to 500 nanometers, they appear to be segmented. And we were accused that that might be some kind of artifact of the gold coating we put on the sample in order to look at it in the electron microscope. But we looked at it with an entirely different technique. We found this is a transmission microscope, and it's a replica technique, and it's totally different. And we found similar things. And these are about the same size, and they also appear to be segmented, and they have 12 to 14 little segments in them. So what are these? Well, as we go back and look at the literature, these are very ancient fossils from the Earth. These things are from Australia, from the Bitter Springs Formation, and they're about a billion years old. And these things have a very strong resemblance to what I showed you in the previous two photos, except that they're much bigger. These are the skinniest one here is about 1 micrometer. Most of them are fatter than that, and they're much longer. So, and they resemble so closely the ones that we published photos of that I recently was accused of taking one of the photos of these and doctoring it and putting it in our paper to pass it off as a Mars fossil. And I had to answer that because it came from a guy in Nevada who had written his senator who wrote me and said, what about this? So I had to prove that we had not taken that photo out of this fossil book and pasted it into a different background. So and this guy had used image analysis. He made digital images and he matched up points and corners, and he had convinced himself that we were a total fraud, that we were pasting these photos from an old fossil book. But that's not correct. And this is just some more bacteria from the fossil record. These are fairly common going back to as old as about 3.5 billion years on the Earth. And the difference between these and what we saw in the Mars meteorite is, again, a matter of size. There's a big difference in size. All right, now I want to finish up with a few charts here, which include some of our latest pictures and kind of a summary of where we are now. And plus, I'll mention the new exciting British data on this topic. Okay. This is, let's see, I was taught how to do this, and I've already forgotten. There we go. You know, Australian technology is too complex for us NASA types. Anyway, what I want to show are a few more pictures from our scanning electron microscope. This is again more of those little clam guys, and yet another one, totally different sample, showing both the clam guys and little spherical ones. Now, this is interesting. I mentioned the desert varnish. In addition to those little elongate worm-like things, we found patches of little spheres in the desert varnish, on the desert varnish. And these little spheres, here's a clump of them here. They're really tiny, 50 nanometers in size, or 500 angstroms. So they're only like 500 atoms lined up across each one of those little spheres. We're talking about small stuff. Are these microorganisms, or are they perhaps some kind of mineral? We don't know for sure, but we do know that we see almost identical looking things in the Mars meteorite shown here. This is a little patch in the Mars meteorite, which also has a lot of spheres of the same size. These are all 50 nanometers average in diameter, and then there are a couple elongate ones down toward the bottom, and some of these spherical ones are joined together in little trains or groups. So we're still trying to work that one out. Now, a very recent discovery in the Mars meteorite is this, which is a very long thread or filament, which appears to be essentially incorporated into the matrix. You can see that it disappears over here and down in the matrix, and then reemerges again. And here, and then up here, it appears to go right through the matrix. So what is that? That is very similar in shape, at least, to a common kind of bacteria, filamentous or thread bacteria, except that, again, it is much smaller. It's only about 20 nanometers wide. Now, this is a mystery, and I'll talk about it. Well, I'll talk about now that if these things are remains of living organisms, and if these, the ones that we see on the Earth, are living organisms or fossil organisms, it's a whole new class of stuff. And we've had people say that, hey, maybe this is a missing link between cells as we understand them and kind of a very early almost non-biological system of reproducing, perhaps using clay templates and so forth. I think it's worth looking at that idea. The other idea is that these things may be fragments of larger organisms which have simply come apart and during the fossil process. And yet a third idea is that if you take some organisms and desiccate them or dry them out, they shrink considerably. These might be shrunken up, dehydrated things that were originally quite a bit bigger. So those are some of the ideas that are bouncing around. We're not at the point where we can pin those ideas down. We're not entirely dependent on these microorganisms for our evidence. In fact, again, in the same meteorite, after some acid etching, we see this stuff. And this stuff here has yet to be identified. We're trying to determine if it's organic. We think it may be. If it's not organic, it could be a clay mineral. If it is organic, there's something that's a dead ringer for it. in nature, which is basically a form of biofilm, a polysaccharide organic a network that bacteria that live in certain water conditions essentially secrete around themselves.